CBS. My name is Roy. This is a Limehouse Tactical Net. Limehouse Tactical Net has been going on for 40-odd years, mostly under the care of Dick, C2RIW, who became a silent sea a little bit over 2 years ago. In his memory, we continue it and try to teach each other things and remind each other of technical things to entertain and inform. So I hope you're all ready for all of that. I wish you a safe 4th of July weekend. So let me begin the little presentation of the usual links. I'll drop and I'll come back with my links.
Thank you very much, and I'm so sorry to hear about the silent sea.
Yes, indeed. We miss Dick a great deal. He still lives on in the archives of the Sexual Net in our hearts. This is just another way of kind of remembering him. Anyway, in order to contact me, if you can't do it through radio, email is a good idea. That would be either for mailbag questions, if you can't ask a question on the Sexual Net, you can email me the question. If you have a topic, if you'd like to present a topic, or be part of a discussion of a topic, or hear about a topic, you can email me and suggest that. If you have a puzzle, we're always looking for technical puzzles to kind of stimulate thought and conversation. So if you have any interesting technical type of puzzles, you can send it to me by email. Or if you want me to pass Paul some USQN on the shoulder and have him take a look at an asteroid space-related story, my email address is mailbag@hc2gs.com. Again, mailbag@hc2gs.com. What's Paul's email address is spacenetreport@gmail.com. I have a link page full of interesting articles available 24/7. So if you're curious, go to the link page any old time. And articles that I have selected from the past week. That address is you type in your browser of roy.hc2gs.com, and that'll take you to the link page. We have a chat room available. Sometimes it's very active, sometimes it's very quiet. You can get to the chat room by typing in your browser chat.hc2gs.com, and it'll take you there. We offer an audio stream for people who are not within radio distance and can't use Echo Link. Type into your browser, technet.ac2gs.com, to give you an audio stream of the W2BL repeater 24/7. And as always, I'd like to remind people, MyKC2NJI has a great archive site called amateurradio.tv that has the archives of the technical net going as far back as December of 2006. Drop for a second, and I'll tell you my plans for tonight.
Thank you, Roy. I'm going to be sitting back listening to all the conversations, and this is KD2ZQY, and I'll be on the side.
Okay. Well, plans are for a regular edition of the technical net. We don't have any special presentations, unfortunately, and I don't have any puzzles, unfortunately. But we will ask if anyone has any questions of technical nature. Hopefully the first few questions will be amateur radio related. As the night progresses, we'll open it up for any scientific discussion, technical discussion, even medicine. Keep in mind that we do not diagnose or treat on the radio, but we can discuss things, so that's available to you. Hopefully, that'll take us to 10:15. Paul, WSUN, will present the SpaceNet report until about 11 o'clock. I'll return, put a bow on it, and wish you a good week. That's the plan, assuming that repeaters, radios, and my voice sticks around long enough. So that's the idea. If anyone out there has any questions of technical nature, please hit that push the talk button, give me your first name, and your call sign.
Thank you, Roy. This is KD2ZQ, Dave, and 73 is to you.
Okay, once again, Ted. Let me wake you up out there, you guys. This is the Weimar Technical Net, and we run on the fuel of questions and topics and such. So if anyone out there has any questions or topics, please feel free to hit that push the talk button. Give me your first name and your call sign.
HT2GX. This is November 2, Mr. Julian Kilo.
Okay, Art, recognize, do you have a question for tonight?
Yes, thank you, Roy. Just an issue with a friend of mine today, having on hand spare electrolytic capacitor for our aircraft. And we got the air radio for electrolytic capacitor. And I have heard somewhere along the line that electrolytic capacitor might be a this is a very old radio system. Dielectric properties break down, and there's a couple of reasons for the modification of the charge. So, I wanted to know what you could confirm, and see if there's any idea how long I can keep the spare capacity.
Okay, just for correction, it's Sierra. It's Alpha Charlie 2 Golf Sierra. Electrolytic capacitors are formed, the electrolyte is formed by running a voltage potential across the two plates. And if you allow them to just sit there uncharged for many years, the material, the dielectric, will break down and has to be either reformed or replaced. A lot of times you'll hear people talk about when they start up a very old piece of equipment, they put a variable transformer in line, and they start at a very low voltage potential, and they slowly ease the voltage setting closer and closer to the normal one for the device, with the idea that as the voltage rises, it will give an opportunity for the electrolytics to possibly reform. You can do it gradual, if you're lucky, you can reform an electrolytic. In some cases, they do dry out, blow up, do all kinds of nasty things. And a lot of times, people will replace the electrolytic capacitors before during part of the rejuvenation process of an old radio. You can't really give a definitive amount of time. It sort of depends upon the overall age of the capacitor itself, when it was manufactured, what quality it was manufactured under, what circumstances it's been left, a capacitor sitting in a box probably is going to last a little bit longer than one sitting in a chassis that's, exposed to all kinds of things. But very cautious people simply replace electrolytics, but less cautious people who use something like a Variac to slowly raise the voltage over hours to give a chance for the old electrolytics to be reformed. Okay, Art, if anyone out there has any further words of wisdom on the subject, there have been known cases where poor quality capacitors have really prematurely aged. There's a site of a motherboard for computers that were using very low quality electrolytic capacitors that were going bad very, very quickly. But again, if anyone else out there has anything to add to the discussion, please feel free to hit the push to talk.
Katie, we apply with a question on the capacitor.
Sure.
There's one recently that I borrowed from somebody. Variac for hours and hours and hours, next day.
if you try to reform them and it's found that you weren't, the problem with reforming is if you run up the voltage too quickly and you don't give it a chance to slowly reform under a slowly increasing voltage, you'll puncture what's left of the electrolytics and ruin the electrode. So what you did was a very good thing, but as I mentioned earlier, there are some that will never come back. They just dried out or burnt out, and all the tampering in the world isn't going to bring back a functioning electrolytic. And so that's where you just need to bite the bullet and replace them.
Cheaper to replace them than blow your transformer into MIN.
Comment. Yes, Ed, you want to comment? I would agree with the previous gentleman. The most cautious of people will simply pull out the old ones and put in some high-quality ones. They're not that terribly expensive, and, you know, there's no question about it. And plus, even if you are able to reform the electrolytics, if they're terribly old, they don't have a great life expectancy. So, again, it depends on how much of a risk you want to take and whether or not it bothers you to just pull out electrolytics and solder. But, Ed, you wanted to make a comment.
K2GJE. I don't put too much faith in the reforming. They're cheap enough, and they're so much smaller than the originals. The only thing is, I had some bad luck replacing some electrolytics in a radio with 150 volt electrolytics, and you would think that would have been okay, but I guess the quality was not that good. It's always buy them a little bit higher in voltage. That's good. The electrolytics that they have in motors that are the starting capacitors, or they're also in air conditioners as part of the starting capacitor for the motor, those are not normal electrolytics. Those cannot be reformed. They're labeled VAC or volt AC only. They're usually a very high microfarads. They're very cheap, but you can't reform those at all. Over.
Which capacitor are you alluding to at this point?
I don't know. I'm trying to pull this radio out of the grave.
They should be replaceable. You might not get the same form factor, but you can probably get the same amount of ferrite, microferrite. Just make sure that the voltage is higher than you need. Having an electrolytic that has too high a voltage rating isn't a problem. Low one definitely is. But I would assume it's not that much of a problem. The only problem, as I see it, would be if it for some reason has to be a particular form factor.
Whether it be Peak Electric Supply or Mouser or Hastings Hamfest, going to get passes into MIN.
I also had experience a few years ago with a company that actually just made paper tubes with modern master stuff, and several perhaps, and there was direct drop, they appeared to be direct drop in replacement for the very old, 50, 60 year old capacitors, and these were capacitors banks, which you call several or two, and they looked great, and they used like a much, much smaller capacitor than this stuff.
Thank you, Mouser. I have the catalog. I appreciate your help. Thank you very kindly. We have a lot of questions.
This is a motor capacity and the dry capacity and the oil fuel capacity. They're not electrolytic.
But do those oil fuel capacitors, do they have a good shelf life? Because it's great enough, I keep one on hand. The next time I air condition inside, I'm going to have to spend a couple horrible nights in Baltimore.
I got old ones here. That's why I like this.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. Wax and the oil capacitors, as long as you store them reasonably well, they shouldn't be a problem. By the way, might be able to get the prepackaged replacement for old components at Antique Radio Supply. I don't think Mauser deals in those. They basically deal in modern components. So the free components, I'm sure you could find at Mauser. If you need a certain amount of voltage, and you need to combine the different capacitors to reach it, then you can do the combining yourself. But I would imagine that you could probably find the capacitor that would fit your needs in Mauser. They have a very, very large catalog of discrete items.
Sell parts for old kit equipment and modifications and all that stuff, and he builds the capacitors to your needs.
Oh, okay. Do you want to repeat that again? Because you doubled with, I think, Andy. So you might not have heard everything that you said.
AC Hamfest. I ordered electrolytic from him for his kit monitor scope. The upgrades on the monitor scope and everything. He carries a lot of stuff, and he'll build your capacity. Into MIN.
Also on the topic of the digital master, I can see where it wouldn't necessarily work well. I recall years ago working with a manufacturer of trunk systems. Yeah, I believe it was trunk systems. Electrical capacitors. And they form their capacitor electrolyzers, bottles, and that was all done, they dumped the execution out, a fresh batch of that same execution. So, what I mean from that is that once you use it, it's not quite as good the second time around.
Cheaper to buy a new one. It's safe insurance.
I can certainly agree with that.
Into MIN.
Okay, very good. We've come to a conclusion. Like I said, electrolytic capacitors usually are not terribly expensive, and make sure that you buy good quality. Don't get it off of eBay from someplace in China, because you'll never quite know how good or bad it is. So get a name brand and buy something that's a higher voltage rating than you'll need, and you should be good. Anyone else with any comments on this particular topic, feel free to hit that push the talk button. Okay, I'm not quite sure about that last signal. It was 89.9% noise. So if you could wiggle the whip antenna, reposition it, put it in the window, or increase the power output of whatever you use to transmit, that would be helpful.
All right, into MIN, I have a question. Anybody ever played with a 4-volt, 5-RV? Anybody ever played with that? I built a home rule.
Well, sort of depends upon the design of the G5RV that you made. There are a lot of different permutations. G5RVs have been around for more than 60 years, I think. The gentleman himself, G5RV, passed away about 10 years ago. It was a funny story that he had an antenna farm where he was working on a lot of different antennas, and people took a look, a walk around and looked, and couldn't find a single G5RV antenna anywhere on his farm. So apparently he had done whatever he was going to do with G5RVs back in the 50s, and didn't look back. But it sort of depends on how you kind of modify it. The earliest standard G5RV has gone through all kinds of modifications. They have G5RV minis, in which the dipole portion is shortened. They have where they start putting RF chokes in places where the original one never designed one to be. So, again, it sort of depends. If you use the standard design that was published back in the 50s, it should work the same way as those do. The problem that I've heard about G5RVs is they're very picky about the surroundings. Since it's such a complicated multimodal antenna design, their surroundings can impact its ability, efficiency on different bands in a bizarre, unpredictable way.
Yeah, well, the one I built is exactly 102 feet.
Okay, so that's the standard length G5RV. It's basically the dipole element is for 20 meters. Then you have the open line that operates other modes. And, you know, it all kinds of, when it works, it works. But again, you know, I've had different guys use the same type of G5RV, and some love the heck out of it, and others hate it. So I think location is important. Elevation is very important. The length of the open line and how it's positioned will impact upon its efficiency on the other modes that it operates on. Anyone else with any opinions of G5RV type antennas out there? Please feel free.
I was wondering, I hate to cut it apart, but see if I could get it to move. Just wondering if anybody else
Okay, what were you planning to shorten? Because there's a lot of different components. Were you going to shorten the dipole portion? Were you going to shorten the open line portion?
I was going to try shortening the dipole portion. Cut the print connector and fold it back on itself 6 inches on the feeder end to get it to 100 feet exactly.
Oh, well, I mean, you might want to, if you have a VNA, you might want to see, tune it for the part of the 20-meter band that you like the best, because apparently in the 20-meter mode, it's purely acting as a dipole. So if you got a VNA hooked up and you can print back the corners and you can resonate it closer to that portion of the 20-meter band that you prefer. Say again, there was a lot of noise on your signal. WS2N? Yes, Paul.
I've had good luck with the G5RV Junior. So it's a shortened version. I mean, it's like the ladder line part. It's got to be like one-third the distance of the full full-size G5RV. But, you know, it's worked on, I still use it on 40 meters. Works very good. My radio doesn't work all that good on the other bands, but when it did, I used to get 20 meters and 15 meters as well. And even a walk band. So that was okay. And it's a lot shorter than you try to fool with you with a long one. Back to you.
Yeah, well, I mean, people do that all the time because 102 feet is a rather long length for a lot of people, so juniors and minis and all those, and they just shrink everything. They'll shrink the amount of open line and kind of tune it for probably 15 meters, some of those are, or some of them are tuned for 10 meters even.
Yeah, okay, and, you know, it's well, let's see, I got it from Oasis, so, and it's set away from, I think they're located in California, but, yeah, it works good, you know, and I also have an independent 80-meter dipole for 80 meters, you know, you know, it won't tune up on 80, that would be great, but it don't. Back over to you, Roy.
Yeah, well, I mean, 80 meters wants a bit of length. You can cheat the things by using loading coils and such, but that raises the Q and diminishes the bandwidth. Then you have to really pick a very narrow portion of 80 meters or 75 meters, unless you have a good antenna system. So sometimes antennas just want to be long. So that's the problem for 160 meters and 80 meters, and why occasionally when the sunspot cycles are in our favor, 10 meters is such a magical band. 6 meters is relatively much easier to get a resonating antenna to operate at 6 meters and 10 meters. When F1 and F2 is energized, you can go all kinds of interesting places with it.
And one more comment about the G5RV. The only thing I don't like is the steel wires, the copper clad. That broke a couple of times, so I found a workaround on that problem. But they tend to break over, you know, as the years go on, you know, with wind back and forth. That becomes a problem, you know, right by the ear. Later. So, you know, outside of that, it's very strong steel, it's copper clad, but, you know, steel also breaks and wiggles around too much.
Yeah, and as well as variations in temperature when it gets cold, it gets a lot more brittle. Copper is a more ductile metal, so it'll stretch before it breaks, but steel doesn't stretch at all. Steel just breaks. So yeah, pick the one, half a dozen the others. There's some people who love copper clad steel. It's a different entity, as you well know. It has a kind of spring-like quality, so you know, you can't just kind of shape it in any direction. It has a memory of its own, so, and it likes to stick to whatever it used to be, you know, rolled into. So it's a little annoying to operate if you're not used to it, but it's certainly physically stronger than the same gauge of copper.
What brand of antenna did you buy that has copper clad steel? What I got from MFJ is copper. I put it right into the wire.
Well, I'll turn that over to Paul. I would imagine you're not going to get copper clad steel from MFJ. They're going to sell you the least expensive material. But, you know, stainless steel is not inherently magnetic. There's two types of stainless steel. One is magnetic, but the other is not. But chances are you just have copper wire. But, Paul, you want to tell them what brand G5RV you bought?
Yeah, it was called Oasis. You know, you're out in the desert. Oasis is the name And if they have copper, next time I'm buying that one. I'm buying the MFJ. Although I found a way around this problem, but I think of course copper is better. For instance, my 80 meter dipole, you know, I mean, that's been up there forever. I mean, the ropes break, but the wires, you know, good for decades. Back to your work.
Okay, I was curious to know if Radio Oasis is still around, and yes, it is. You just Google Radio Oasis antennas, and you'll find them.
Does that antenna come with a camera?
Did it come with a what? I missed that.
I said, can it come with a camel?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, but... it had to quit because it couldn't put smoking, so no more camels.
Okay. Okay, very good. I think we're talked out, but if there's anyone else who has any other comments to make about G5RVs, they were incredibly popular, I think about 14-odd years ago. It was kind of like every other guy was talking about a G5RV. And then about 8 years ago, I don't know, it's just everyone stopped talking about it, and they moved on, right? These days, if you kind of talk to the average guy who's thinking about an antenna, usually discussion of NSFs comes up a lot. They're not the most efficient. They're certainly the easiest with two mounting points. All the others have more than two, but G5RVs did have a time in the sun.
So depending on which way you have it, that's the direction you book yourself into MIN.
Okay, I mean, to a degree it's the directionality of it, but also because it uses the open lines are kind of finicky. If it rains, it changes the characteristics. If you put it too close to the ground, it changes characteristics. If you put it near conductors, it changes the characteristics. So I think the G5RV just has a lot more variables than almost any other antenna I can think of being used these days. So I think that's probably why we hear a kind of very broad range of opinions. Almost no two opinions are identical. Everyone has either a great story or a terrible story. Yeah.
Alpha Bravo 6, Mike Bravo.
Yes, Jeff. Jeff, by the way, is the next control operator for the Papa Technical Antenna Net every Friday night at 10 o'clock Eastern Time. If you can find a connection to the Papa Network, he's here every Friday night giving a great technical net on antennas. But what do you have to tell us tonight, Jeff?
Okay, Roy, thank you very much. If anybody wants to join us on Friday night, just go to my QRZ page. I'm Alpha Bravo 6, Mike Bravo. We're a multi-mode net, so there's a lot of different ways to get in with DMR, D-Star, P25, etc., All-Star. So just drop on my QRZ page, and I have the listing of all the different busy information for that. Roy, the one thing I wanted to comment on was that I had my first antenna in 1991 when I got my license was the half-size G5RV that I bought at a swap meet here in the Bay Area to have my first amateur radio swap net. And it came in a bucket. But basically it had, it was 52 feet or thereabouts, and then it was fed with a section of ladder line, which I think was 17 feet, and that entered some RJ-X coax, which I would never have done these days. I think what happened was people realized, and even T5RV said it himself, that you're better off just running straight ladder line to that link wire. And T5RV said if he had to do it over again, he would have never used the matching section. So I think that's just a gradual movement away from that and just going to straight ladder line or as more of a norm now. And that's my comment on it. Back to you, AV6MB.
Okay, so in other words, instead of the open line transitioning to a coax, he was recommending just ladder line straight to your antenna tuner.
That's what I read. He just said if he had to do it over again, he would have skipped it and just gone straight ladder line. And there's a lot of good reasons for that. So I think that, for multiband use, I think it was better off using ladder line, maybe 6MB.
Okay, but I mean, basically he was describing using it as a non-resident doublet, which I know people do. They just set up non-resident doublets as opposed to a resident dipole, and they feed it with low-loss open line of some kind, including ladder line, and then they feed it into preferably a balanced antenna tuner and transform the impedance to a value that their transmitter can take. So that's a curious thing that the developer of the T5RV basically just wanted to turn his rather esoteric multimodal invention into a relatively simple doublet.
The only problem with balanced line, you can't have it touch anything. It's got to be suspended.
Yes. Well, even an unbalanced line, if you're doing a Wyndham, if you even do an off-center, you can't have it touching things. You need to have it insulated from any ground until you get to the balance for the unum.
Let's see if I can. The T5RV was developed as a 20-meter antenna to have a nice pattern for where he was to hit all the areas he wanted to hit. And but the fact that he could also order up a multiband was just an afterthought. It really was never designed for that. It worked, of course, with a good antenna tuner, but it was never designed for that. That was designed just to be a 20-meter antenna with a pattern that T5RV wanted for where he lived. AV6MB.
Okay, that's interesting information. Yeah, I mean, it's quite suitable as a 20-meter cut. The 102-odd feet is cut to be resident for 20 meters. It's just the open line operating as a transforming sub and a few other modes that kind of get you to the different bands. The full-blown T5RV, I think, has been used for 80 meters to 10 meters. The T5RV Junior, which is half the length of the dipole cut, is more designed for 10 to 40 meters. But again, I don't know, generally it's kind of fallen out of favor as far as I've seen. You hear people talking a lot about NFED. I haven't heard that many people talking about T5RV for the last few years.
Well, I think they realized the shortcomings of that matching section with high SWRs on the other bands, and like myself, I just went to straight ladder line, and that has worked very well for me. And I went in, like you said, put it into a ballon and into your tuner, and it'll work fine. But I think that's what happened. They just found that it's just better to run straight ladder line in that section. And that's kind of what I think would happen. It just transitioned into another form, 3D600.
Okay, I think also what happened is every generation, someone had a clever idea of making it shorter, of making the open line window pane or some other open line type of length shorter. Other people started to put chokes on it, which kind of undermined some of the modes that people theorize make it work. You know, if you put a choke in the wrong place, then parts of the open line aren't going to give you any kind of impedance matching transmission line magic. So, yeah, I guess people just found simpler solutions. Ultimately, I think G5RV suffered from being a little bit more complicated than most amateur radio operators want to deal with.
Yeah, I have to agree with you completely. I think we just looked at it and said, why don't we just run straight ladder line? You know, when you think about it. Okay, Roy, back to you. Good discussion, though. I enjoyed it. Maybe 6MB.
Likewise, I've known a few people who swear by doublets. They're a lot less troubled. I don't know how efficient they are. The problem is that most amateur radio operators are able to measure some parts of their operations and not other parts. They know what their standing wave ratio is. They know what the impedances are. They can even spot the resonance curves. But since very few people can afford an anechoic chamber and signal readings for in three-dimensional space, most of the time the radiation patterns that we all see are computer-generated, and sometimes they're just generated by the public relations arms of antenna manufacturers. So it's a shame we can't really easily discern the efficiency of our antennas, although it would probably depress us. I've been told that on rare occasions where it's obviously a very low efficiency device, it's kind of remarkable. If you want to, for some odd reason, be mobile on 80 meters and get yourself a very shortened vertical with a bottom-loaded inductor, that you could possibly be operating with an efficiency of about 1%. Ooh, awful. But again, because there's no efficiency meter on any of our radios, most of us would be blissfully unaware of that. Anyone else with any comments on this particular topic before we ask for another one?
KD2WOT.
Yes, Chris.
Yeah, good evening, Roy, and everybody on the net. I was on the 10-meter net earlier, as you know, and using a new antenna that I made, and it was basically just from a piece of, RG58 coax. I guess a G2LT.
Okay, and it worked beautifully.
Yeah, incredible. Prior to that, I had been using a jet wave antenna. This was far, far better. I was with maybe 10 or 15 watts, and I think you heard me pretty well. It's an excellent antenna. It's just, I guess, on the lower band, it would, start to get very, very long from its practice.
yeah, that's what I was alluding to earlier tonight, that with the 6 meters and 10 meters, it's much more forgiving. You can not really worry too much about the mechanical aspect, and as you go down the band, it becomes a bigger and bigger factor and kind of overwhelms the situation. You know, like, everyone sort of knows a guy who has a 10-meter Yagi and probably a 15-meter Yagi, maybe a 20-meter Yagi, but, you know, there's very, very few guys out there with 80-meter Yagis probably buying a motor a year because those things will burn out no matter where you get the damn motor. So, yeah, with 10 meters, you can try out a lot of different ideas. Yours worked very well today. Did you hear the distance transmission? We had a little bit of an opening, and we were talking to the Midwest out there.
Yeah, I think I heard somebody from Missouri. And I had a QSO with someone yesterday with 20 watts, way out Long Island. Like Patchogue area or something, you know, something pretty far out. But the other thing too, with that antenna is it's very, very low Q, no tuner, first of all, without using any tuner, very low SWR, and through the whole 28 meters, pretty solid. It goes up to about 1.5 or something like that. Nothing above that.
Okay, sounds like a good design for your purposes. Yeah, I think it's very popular also with TV antennas.
Yes, that's true. That's how I stumbled upon the design on YouTube. Basically, somebody built it for 11 meters, but I just cut it to the 10 meters. But it'll actually, it looks like it's going to be 11 meter band as well.
Yeah, there's a lot of cross purpose. I mean, I use a Curio 5/8 wave antenna for my 10 meters, and it also has an adjustable width top where you can slide it in and out and tune it either for 10 meters or 11 meters. There are actually guys, I think, another way of describing it is a bazooka antenna. There are guys out there that actually build them for the lower band. They need a lot more hardware to support them because they can get kind of heavy.
Yeah, it seems to go by a couple of different names. It's D2L2, which is the tuned transmission line trap. The bazooka antenna, vertical dipole, and kind of an offshoot of that is what's called the Game Master, which was a matching stuff.
Yeah, it's an interesting design. I'm collecting a bunch of things to run through antenna simulators. Maybe I'll look it up and see if anyone has a nice antenna simulation for it. It's probably going to be a problem because once you introduce coaxial cables, antenna simulators, you usually have to kind of play tricks with it to get it to coax cables. It tends to like very, very simple segments of wire, but I'll take a look and see if that's possible.
Yeah, that'd be great. I was also, as I was perusing antennas, looking at the magnetic loop, which seems to be very interesting. Far more complex and very, very high Q. So
actually have put into the antenna simulator and run some software and actually written an article, and I think I've mentioned before that I'll be giving it to the club for the newsletter in the fall. But you know, magnetic loops are surprisingly not that complicated when you really think about it. They're basically just a sort of foot and dipole where you take both ends and you put them very close to each other, and then you couple them with a variable capacitor. So they become resonant with a very high Q, as you mentioned, and so they have very narrow received bandwidth, and so when you're tuning it with a variable capacitor, you best use something like a Bernier gear reduction device, because you can overshoot resonance very quickly. The lightest touch on the variable capacitor. Because of the high Q, you need something that has a very high voltage breakdown. Because as the Q goes up, the voltage potentials at either edge of the antennas go up and up and up. So it requires retuning regularly. If you got a lot of scratch, you can build a servo motor and a SWR noise bridge and automate the process. But it's probably not terribly efficient, but you don't need elevation. You just put it up, say, 10 feet off the ground, and it works beautifully, and you don't need any radial. So it's an interesting design.
Yeah, true. I agree. Yeah, very interesting design. And, you know, the problem always with the capacitors, they use like butterfly plates or vacuum caps or trombone capacitors, different things like that. And it starts to get very expensive, and and very high Q.
Yeah, there are incredibly expensive commercial versions of magnetic loops. A lot of people, and I've seen on Twitter and such, they'll go to a local Home Depot, they'll buy some copper tubing that's designed to connect your refrigerator to your plumbing or to the water, and they'll get a variable capacitor, and they'll build a relatively cheap but somewhat effective magnetic loop. Commercial ones, they kind of start in the hundreds of dollars, and there's an Italian company called Hero Mazzoni that sells these enormous, monstrous, one of them is called a baby magnetic loop, which is a misuse of the term baby if ever I saw it, in which it actually uses a thick metal plate separated distances away that mesh together on a motor to adjust the capacitor. And those things are bent objects. Most magnetic loops are sort of designed to be either portable or semi-portable. A lot of them use a coax cable as the conducting loop. So use either LMR 400 or sometimes LMR 600. And so you just put it in a duffel bag and carry it around.
Yeah, and I believe I saw that Hero Mazzoni. I think it goes for about $2,500 or something like that.
Yeah, they sell two models. One is the baby that I think is kind of designed for 10 to 40, and then they sell a bigger one that's designed for something like 15 or 20 to 80. But yeah, thousands of dollars. In the old days, people had to import it from manufactured in Italy. We got a distributor a few years ago, GS Engineering, distributed it in the United States. I would love to see a YouTube on it. I've been looking around, but I haven't quite found anything. It's kind of surprising. There's a lot of things on magnetic loops. A lot of YouTube built their own. Unfortunately, there was an engineer who promised he was going to present an entire a series of YouTube about a automated servo controlled a magnetic loop that she built from scratch. But I think she got busy with some business venture. She never completed any but the very first YouTube of all the promises. But it's fascinating design, and it has benefits and it has limitations. Again, I would love to be able to measure the efficiency of these devices, because since this acts like a short dipole, what effectively that means is the radiation resistance. The effect of energy that's turned into electromagnetic waves is lower than for most other antenna radiators. So any insertion loss that's not radiation resistant goes into waste heat. So it's kind of designed to be inefficient, but you're never quite sure how inefficient, because there's no very good way of measuring the efficiency of antennas, at least for us hams.
Yeah, very good. Okay, well, thanks very much, Roy. I'll kick it back to you, and I'll be standing by 7-3 for now.
Okay, you're welcome, Chris. Once again, I am ACCGS. My name is Roy. This is the Weimar Technical Mess. So if you have any questions or topics you would like to discuss, or comments to be made, please hit that push-to-talk button and give me your first name and call sign.
Hey, David, I'm here in West Hampton, 82ZQY, and I definitely have an antenna question.
Okay, Dave, give it to us.
I have about a 30 or 25 foot vertical antenna, and I was hoping to put a dipole on the antenna, and I'm just wondering if it will interact with the vertical with the dipole.
Okay, so the point is that you would like to actually use your vertical as a mast for another antenna that would be that would operate as a dipole. Is that what you're trying to say?
Yes, exactly. It would act as a inverted dipole.
Okay, I think you mean an inverted V dipole. I would not suggest that because, you know, I mean, theoretically, and I kind of hate to end up talking theoretical because we don't live in a theoretical world. If you keep things at right angles and you keep things at different resonant frequencies, they shouldn't see each other that much and they shouldn't interact. But in the real world, you're going to have something that's not at right angles. You're going to have an inverted V that's drooping on either side, and you're going to have a resonant conductor in the middle of all that. It's probably going to make sort of a mess. As long as you don't operate both of them at the same time, I don't think anything terrible will happen. But it will certainly be a complicated affair, and it would probably not work as well as finding simply another support beam for your inverted V.
Okay, 10 feet below that, I can run a regular dipole in my attic. And I was just wondering if that's better than trying to run an inverted V on the same mass as my vertical.
Yeah, I would say it would be more effective. I mean, it's always better to have the antenna on the outside than the inside, but assuming that you don't have any metal shielding on your roof, I know people who have put antennas in their attics, and they get good responses with it. So